Welcome to the A-News Podcast. This is episode 88 for November 2nd, 2018. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the previous week on Anarchist News. It's designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism at our email address, podcast@anarchistnews.org. For more information, and usually some good commentary, go to the nonsectarian anarchistnews.org. Editorial, Heroes and Martyrs. I have a knee-jerk reaction to the word martyr, mostly because if Christians like it, then it must be bad. But Christianity, with all its body hatred, its Manichaean dualism, and its postponement of rest, happiness, and satisfaction till an unlikely afterlife, doesn't get to own the urge to die for something important or the acceptance of death in pursuit of something important. These are days of ever-decreasing possibilities for meaningful action, or at least action that has any hope of lasting impact. And the urgency is undeniable and unremitting. There is so much inertia on so many levels and so many different directions that need attending to, and so little evidence that people are even paying attention or that attention means anything. But doing things is not math, much as activists and organizers want us to think it is. It's not a matter of this much repression minus these options plus access to a kind of information equals a particular sort of action. The monks who set fire to themselves, the cop-killing snipers, the Casey Brezicks, the Ted Kaczynskis. Choosing death, especially our own deaths, is the most dramatic and heartfelt plea we can make to the society that engulfs us far beyond the mechanism that mangled Charlie Chaplin's body in modern times. We are so small in relation to the forces in the world. On the one hand, martyrdom is the other side of the coin of heroes, and this culture is hooked on heroes. Most of us have watched or read too much Hollywood propaganda, and our heads are wrapped in dreams of David versus Goliath, of the underdog who doesn't give up and against all odds wins in the end. But despite the inadequacy of these myths, despite how they play into maintaining the culture that we reject, it's not like we can find other convincing options, and sometimes the best we can do is pick a Goliath and throw our body at it. What's new this week? From the prison strike to the Greek prison struggle, from It's Going Down, an interview with an imprisoned member of the Conspiracy of Cells of Fire who demonstrates how anarchist prisoners are mostly different in Greece, where there is a tradition of refusing to plead innocent or even recognize the authority of the courts, how prisons are different in Greece, where they are gradually catching up with the tactics and structures of U.S. prisons, and how and why prisoners remain active while inside. Quote, although as an anarchist, I believe that prisons cannot be improved, the road to freedom goes beyond their ruins, I do participate in struggles that seek to improve the conditions of detention. The reason is that I do not believe in the objective conditions that all prisoners will wake up one day and rise up against prisons. The prisoners are like society. Many are accustomed to their chains of slavery and do not react. So these struggles to improve conditions may be some reform, but they can also act as an alarm or detonator, causing chain reactions. Besides, I feel better when I fight for something than for being imprisoned. Unquote. Inspirational. Quote, for me, prison is not just the deprivation of freedom, it is the place of non-memory. Here people are forgotten, buried alive, and their memory fades. Changes in the correctional code are burying us even more, and they impose a quarantine condition in prisons, which even the little charms of freedom won by blood have to be shut down and shielded with the iron power of the law. Unquote. Write a prisoner today.
The proletariat of Brazil was defeated by democracy, not dictatorship, from Ediciones Inéditos. Both the original Spanish and the English translation of a piece from a Chilean who calls out previous Brazilian governments for destroying the working class, a destruction that the recent election only highlights. Again, very tempting to see mirrors of the U.S. situation here. Quote, like all fascists, Bolsonaro has simply come to bring to order business after progressive democracy has taken the Brazilian proletariat out of the game, reducing it to nothing. Keep this in mind when you start to complain about the arrival of fascism. These laments are already too late. They should have become panicked and outraged when the social democratic left disarmed the proletariat, manipulated them, and anesthetized them with lies. These frightened complaints heard all over are pathetic. It only shows that those who moan have been sleeping, living in a fantasy, refusing to see the blood and shit rising under their noses. sinking little by little to the beat of electoralism and samba drummers, unquote. The final sentences seem tone-deaf and disagreeable, and will trigger knee-jerk antifa, but given the rest of the text, I'm inclined to give the author the benefit of the doubt, as were the folks at Ediciones and Editos as well.
The Postmodern Anarchist Revolution, from Dissident Voice by Michelle-Luc Bellemare. The Dissident Voice calls itself a radical newsletter in the struggle for peace and social justice. For those who follow such things, this article is a refutation of the materialism of Marx and Bukharin, who argue that it's the means of production that determine society. This author has the more anarchist-friendly analysis that social relations are more determinative on the means of production than vice versa. Quote, Bukharin argues that revolutions are due to the productive forces having outgrown the envelope of production relations. For postmodern anarchism, it is the other way around. It is the networks of production relations that outgrow the productive forces and, in effect, begin to press heavily upon the productive forces to make them evolve or perish. New relations of production require new organizational forms of production, i.e., new configurations of productive forces. In essence, new networks of relations embody new sets of requirements, and this demand for new requirements places undue pressure upon the forces of production. They must meet these new requirements through reorganization or perish, unquote. He also argues that an aging elite is desperately denying the reality of society's disintegration, which will obviate their power. I call for a mud wrestling match between this author and Jay-Z.
Two comrades are imprisoned in Poland, from Anonymous. This is information about and defense of two people who were arrested because they refused to do community service. One of them has been swallowed by the system, and they are unable to get any information about him. The other is on hunger strike because the prison will not provide vegan options or warm clothing for the unheated prison cell they keep him in. Quote, we support our friends. Law considers community services an opportunity to strengthen the society, but in our opinion, it is only another way to force people to do something and to exclude them from economic debates. Our comrades are trying to show that self-organizing and radical actions can do much more for society than community services. We want to stress that the arrested comrades are not victims. They are resistant, and we support their decision of rejecting to perform punitive community services, unquote.
Finding a way forward. From the South Essex Heckler, which calls itself, quote, radical news, views, and agitation with an anarchist twist, unquote. Even without the name of this site, it's obvious from the first couple paragraphs that this piece was from the UK, because no one takes their class analysis seriously like those folks from across the pond. They complain about inaccessible language, which could be valid. Jargon is frequently a shortcut that means writers are not thinking about things clearly. Or not so valid. Claims of inaccessibility are frequently attacks on reflecting on complicated ideas or situations. They complain about the assumptions in meetings, which can be off-putting to newcomers. They complain about academia determining too much of anarchist discourse, etc. If you're organizing or activating, then this article might have something to say to you. If you're jaded and cynical, then it sounds like something from people who need to reread nihilist communism.
Brazil, the alternative to fascism is not democracy, from CrimeThink. Wow. The advertisements for a CrimeThink book take up a phenomenal amount of the page train here. I guess they've said it all in a book that you can buy for the low, low price of whatever. Let me be clear. Marketing as anarchists is a contradictory and tricky endeavor. But CrimeThink seems more and more like those folks who stick their papers in your face. Other than that, Brazil is in for some hard/harder times, and we should be prepared to support them, somehow. Maybe by buying a CrimeThink book?
On the attack on the FSB in Russia, from CrimeThink. Quote, today, a young Russian anarchist died in an attack on the FSB headquarters in Ankarelsk. The FSB has gotten its wish, bullying young Russians into carrying out bombings rather than engaging in public organizing, unquote. What the fuck? The brainwashing and surveillance forces of the U.S. have apparently gotten their wish by getting CrimeThink to come down against unequivocal, clear violence against repression. It's fine to argue tactics, but the first thing they have to say is that FSB won through this action? The article ends by calling him a hero, but that just makes the whole thing confusing.
Russian anarchists detonate self at Federal Security HQ, from the BBC. Our second piece on this suicide action is the mainstreamiest, submitted by Anonymous. The submitter points to a link in the article to a mass shooting in Crimea and correctly wonders if this is the BBC's effort to depoliticize the FSB bombing. Here's the text of the social media post he left. Quote, comrades, now in the FSB building in Arkhangelsk, there will be a terrorist attack, the responsibility for which I take upon myself. The reasons are clear to you. Since the FSB fabricates cases and tortures people, I decided to go for it. Most likely, I will die because of the explosion, because I have initiated the charge directly by pressing the button attached to the bomb cover. Therefore, you are requested to spread information about the terrorist attack, who committed it, and what the reasons were. Well, sort of like everything. I wish you to go unswervingly and uncompromisingly towards our goal. Like to you, the future of anarchist communism, unquote.
London, call out for solidarity with Russian anti-fascists from Freedom News. This is a call out for folks in London to help organize a solidarity event on January 19th, 2019. Quote, January 19th is a significant day for anti-fascists and anarchists, as each year demonstrations are held to remember Russian comrades, the journalist Anastasia Babarova and lawyer Stanislav Markolov, who were murdered by fascists in broad daylight 10 years ago, as well as other fallen comrades who were victims to fascist violence. Markolov, an experienced lawyer and social democrat, spent years fighting for justice in worker struggles, environmental protests, and against the violence of the Russian state. Babarova, a young journalist with independent Russian newspaper Novaya Gazeta, was a reporter and anarchist from Sevastopol, Crimea. They were murdered in Moscow by a nationalist terror group with links to the Kremlin, unquote. Maybe we can get some joint actions in other places?
An anarchist response to the free speech debate from C4SS by Ray Ling. This is not new reasoning. It's pretty much the same arguments about why they don't get to talk and we do, and how that totally makes sense. However, the comments in this thread are pretty good. The Karl Popper quotation on the paradox of tolerance iterates the most relevant parts of the original article, but more concisely. Neither, however, addresses things like context for speech, and what makes talking about things in one frame different from talking about those same things in a different frame. Do you want to subscribe to my context newsletter?
In Arkhangelsk, anarchist Misha Zobitsky explodes FSB reception from a2day.net. The third piece on this, we finally get an appropriate response to Misha's action. Quote, we bow our heads before the heroism of our comrade. We were not acquainted in life, but through communication, he left an impression of himself as an intelligent and well-prepared person who is not indifferent and inspires to go beyond the swamp of the official opposition struggle, which is now mainstream. There is no doubt that Mikhail acted purposefully, understood his motives crystally, and consciously sacrificed himself during the action. It is impossible to read the stories of our comrades about the nightmarish torture in the dungeons of the Gestapo FSB without the heart bleeding and without being overwhelmed with a thirst for revenge for sadists in uniform. When a feeling of indignation and a desire for justice fills up the cup of patience, when internal moral conflict becomes intolerable for an honest person, then concern for their own welfare retreats before deciding to call the scoundrels to account. Anarchists often did this in the past, rushing into a suicide attack on a tyrant and executioner, unquote.
Video and audio, Free Radical Radio Books Podcast, The Unique and Its Property by Max Stirner, A Close Reading, Part 2, an hour and a half. It's too bad that Rydra misunderstood my point last week about no women being interested in talking to him about this topic. But it's certainly better to have no women than have a token, so cool. Aside from that, this is a fun Dungeons & Dragons session on philosophy and Stirner, complete with cleric, rogue, various alignments, and a dungeon master. Hey, if someone sounds like Rick of Rick and Morty, that's a good sign. As a listener, I would say this suffers from a circularity that conversations about philosophy tend towards. It could perhaps be addressed by having or taking notes, but no doubt that would make the conversation less fun for the players. Some provocative ideas are floated slash introduced, and really, what more can we ask for? Rydra has a very nice quip, aka a historically appropriate new definition of communist. On the other hand, he ends the podcast by asking the definition of a sophomoric philosophy question. Give with one hand, take with the other.
Beer and rage. Anarchy is not order. Anarchy is not chaos. Two videos. The first one is 13 minutes. The second one is 10 and a half minutes. The first one is on how anarchy is not order or chaos and features a hurricane malt liquor. The host discusses the circle A symbol and symbolism and argues that the O in the circle A does not equal order, despite what many people say. He doesn't demonstrate any reason for that assertion about the symbol, just tells people to prove him wrong. To explain how anarchy doesn't mean order, he refers to the Latin origins of the word and how the origin of order implicitly requires a leader. This is kind of a Glenn Beck stream of consciousness rant, which worked for Beck for a long time. So, okay. He defines anarchy as fluid, voluntary relationships between everybody, which certainly has the benefit of simplicity. The second video is more about disconnecting anarchy from chaos and features Ice House Edge malt liquor. He references the pamphlet called The Anarchist Beast and uses the Mad Max world as the exemplar of chaos.
Anarchy Radio, October 30th, 2018, an hour. Jay-Z starts out by picking a comment from A-News to make assumptions about, pulling nihilism and other labels out of thin air to complain about, again. He also seems to call the pipe bombs whores, which seems contradictory for someone who enjoys cop killings. John's complaint this episode about people calling for anarchist celebrities events, which I agree with in general, would however ring a lot more true if he didn't only pull it out when people call for things that he doesn't want to do. Other than that, he plays the celebrity game for all it's worth.
Topic of the week. Choice or not choice? Well, I thought this was going to be about feminism, but I can already see it could be more about poking the egoists. When I was young, I rejected all things gender expected for myself. As I aged, I found myself doing plenty of gender expected things, areas of ignorance and of competence, for example, and only occasionally beating myself up about it. I have mixed feelings about this, sometimes accepting it as a part of being part of a culture, however fucked up it is, parts are unavoidable, sometimes feeling lazy or boring because I didn't push myself harder, sometimes leaving open the option that people do just have strengths and weaknesses that are not necessarily or always about cultural paradigms. In these days of gender fluidity, in which people still act out plenty of expectations, but with more cover, how do you address this? How do you resist or accede to gendered or other expectations? What is the point now of resisting them? It used to be about broadening the potential for the categories of woman and man, but those are seeming like concepts that have now been sidestepped and may no longer be worth directly confronting. And for the real theory heads out there, what do you think of the shift from body-based feminism, in which knowledge, power, etc. come from nature and our bodies, to a feminism that refutes the body? Ariel, thoughts?
Well, that's a lot of questions.
Yes, this particular person does seem to have that problem.
Let's see.
Do you think your feminism is of the body?
Oh, my feminism is absolutely of the body. I was raised and spoon-fed second wave feminism, and that.
But you didn't migrate from that position.
I guess in my own personal politics, I did not migrate from it, but I have now, spent enough time talking to other people who come from the generations after me, and I certainly understand. I understand feeling like the body that you live in is not yours, is not your ally, or that you're trapped in it, or that it's working against you and wanting to, as one person told me, claw your way out of it, or reject its presence, or I get it.
Not really you.
No, I was fortunate. I was always very comfortable being who I was and the body I was in, that I am in. It took me a long time to wrap my head around it. I think that the question of resisting or acceding gender expectations is probably the most interesting question in here.
For you.
Because I have always been very comfortable in the body that I am in, but I have been told for a lot of my life that I carry lots of male behavioral traits. And I feel like the politics of gender is much more essentialist now than it was 20 years ago. I do. That you can't, that if you are a girl who is loud, who likes to climb trees, who wants to, play with bugs and be outside, then that means that you're genderqueer or you're male identifying or, and it can't just be that you're a girl that likes these things. And I find that partly peculiar, but also a little frustrating. And then you know, the same thing, boys. And it feels like a different, more sophisticated version of my grandfather's brothers talking about the boy in the family that played with dolls and how that wasn't okay because it made him some kind of fairy. And it's a different perspective and a different approach, but there's an essentialism in there that I frequently just don't know what to do with.
It's funny because really what you're talking about is the way in which we're trained to gender.
Yeah.
And even though we're both single children, you're somehow not, in that you were surrounded by family, whereas I was absolutely not surrounded by family. Mm-hmm. And so it seems like you had a lot more training going on around you, to mixed results or whatever, but a lot more training going around about you. I really didn't think about gender as being a thing until I hit puberty.
Hmm.
I didn't have any other people around me.
Right.
I had books.
Yeah.
They did not judge.
Sure. Well, but I also think it was different, right? We're both children of the 70s.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I remember being in the first grade, maybe, the second grade, and being called a tomboy. And so I think as the way that the second wave feminist movement changed culturally, there was a way to talk about girls who were different in a way that there wasn't a way to talk about boys who might be different. You know, even, I mean, literally like on the playground by other children.
Sure.
But you were weird in different ways. And so, and you know, you were also not of the dominant culture. So,
sure.
You know, there were other reasons to poke at you and talk about you. So, of course, you know, in the first or second grade, I didn't know that this was about gender, but I was always aware that I was not like other girls. It was made pretty clear to me.
So the author does this caveat right in the beginning where they say that this isn't going to be about feminism, and yet it feels like it entirely is. Why do you think they thought that this was going to be a critique of egoism? I don't see that.
I can honestly see it be more about poking the egoists. Well, I mean, it feels like at least the four comments that I glanced over are the egoists.
Knee-jerking.
Yeah, knee-jerking, and they're pretty ridiculous, dumb comments.
Yeah, they don't seem like people you want to hang out with.
Well, it's actually even worse than that because, of course, their responses indicate that I disagree with them, which kind of makes me want to lean into them and poke at them and see if I can get a good argument out of them. But the truth is, you probably can't. And that's even more disappointing, is that not only do you not want to hang out with them, then they can't be good adversaries either. So they're just entirely useless. And that's disappointing.
Your editorializing is getting a little thick here.
Is it? No, it's my day. What do you want? I guess probably because in this context on AIMS, you can't use the word gender this much without that being one of the branches, is the irritating the egoists. Irritating anybody who wants to kind of in a blanket way line themselves up against identity without any thought. That seems a reasonable expectation, but we're not the people. Those are not the people who are having this discussion. We are, so.
So we stopped the recording to have some oblique commentary on the product that I use in my hair. Speaking of...
Oblique, I'm offended. I appreciate the comment about sometimes feeling lazy or boring because I don't push myself harder.
Well, you've never particularly... I've never really seen you push yourself along the question of gender. I mean, you would be someone who most people would consider a pretty gender-conforming person.
I am, but part of that is intentional. Because growing up, there were all these things that girls did that I didn't do.
So you're a tomboy.
And I didn't have a mother. Like, the way that my mother guided me as being a girl or a woman through the world was about self-protection mostly.
Yeah, I was going to say, like your main activism, for lack of a better language, has been around self-defense. And
right.
That absolutely comes from your mother.
Right, absolutely. So there are all these little things, like, I never learned how to properly put on makeup.
Mm-hmm.
As a Black woman, I didn't learn how to properly do my hair the way Black women do their hair.
Sure.
Until I was in my 20s. Mm-hmm. And one of my best friends literally sat me down and was like, I'm tired of your hair looking like this. I'm going to show you how to do this. I never was thoughtful about clothes or fashion or how I dress until I became an adult and it became a professional thing. And so there are all these ways in which I, like, my inevitable uncomfortableness in a room full of women is pending. And part of it is because I don't think I belong there, and I'm pretty sure they're going to sniff me out and know that I don't belong there, because there are all these, from my understanding, from my generation, fundamental ways of being a woman that I don't know how to be. And so all of the ways in which traditionally I embody a woman's roles, I like to cook. I, on some level, like to keep house. Those came naturally for me. Those, I'm good at those things. I had small cousins in my life who I helped raise, so there's a little bit of mother in me. So I kind of leaned into those. As you know, like my declaration of, see, look, I'm a woman too. Yeah. So it was we plant our flags in our territory and decide where we're going to be legit. And I guess that was mine.
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting question, largely because it is a generational question.
For sure.
I mean, you know, most of these questions are not my questions.
Right.
They're not how I've been challenged. Mm-hmm. And I very much see that pretty much everybody who's 5 to 10 years younger than me and younger,
mm-hmm.
for all of them, this is a core thing that they have to grapple with,
yeah.
at the same time that they're grappling with all the other things.
Yeah. I mean, it's actually kind of amazing. I have had opportunities multiple times to have these conversations with people in their 20s, and the depth of these questions and the things that they're thinking about and what they're engaging with is, I'm not sure that I could have done that when I was their age.
Yeah.
And they are absolutely, without exception, politically some of the most interesting and even for me challenging conversations that I have, if for no other reason that even when I'm talking to other cis women, we're starting from such fundamentally different places to have those conversations. Mm. And of course, the less like me the people I'm talking to are, the more interesting those conversations get. But just even the language to talk about gender and identity along those lines, we didn't even have it. We didn't have those words. I remember the first time Girl Army was discussing bringing a male-bodied, female-identified person into a class from an organization that up to that moment had very explicitly defined itself as a women's self-defense organization. Mm-hmm. And us figuring out what we did with that and all of the language around gender and genderqueer and identity. And we didn't have any of that.
Hmm.
That wasn't part of the lexicon yet.
Was it
yet.
In the 90s?
Yeah. Still? Yeah, it was in the 90s. And so while we understood that this was an important thing to do, how did we talk to other women?
Sure.
I put that in quotes. In the class, who did not expect there to be for a lack of a better way and a crass way to put it, a penis in the class.
Yeah.
And that, and, you know, I mean, again, this was in the 90s. So Girl Army has figured all of this out now. But I remember at the time, what was supposed to be like, you know, an hour-long conversation turned into a half-day agonizing meeting about how do we do this thing that nobody knows how to do and nobody knows how to talk about.
Right.
And the deftness and sophistication with which 22-year-old kids just move through these things is, you know, that's when I feel old, because it's a little jaw-dropping to me. And because this is just the conversations that happen in the world.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Welcome to Redacted, the only show willing to break the fourth wall in a world full of memorized and regurgitated scripts. This is Suds, and today I'm joined with my friends Hemlock and Plast. Welcome to the show, you two.
Happy to be on, comrade.
And speaking of comrades, the subject of today's show is kind of a little outside of our regular cadence. It is going to be about five-year plans. And when I say that, I am not talking about being a tanky. So it's kind of tough to say exactly why talking about a five-year plan is important within an anarchist context. And we'll kind of like get into that as we go. And so I'm just going to give just a quick kind of breakdown of exactly what it is that I mean. And the fastest way that I can discuss this is basically you shoot for the stars. So within a five-year time period, what is something amazing that it is that you would like to accomplish? Whether it be that you have an enormous reputation on a website, whether it be that you are running a fantastic anarchist worker cooperative, such as the now deceased Red and Black Cafe in Portland, Oregon, or any number of these other sorts of examples that it might actually take some time for you to achieve A to B. And essentially, you work backwards. You say, okay, within that five-year time period, each year, I'd like to accomplish maybe these 2 to 3 goals. You break that down into your monthly set. You break that down into your weekly set. And then you break that down into daily to-do lists. So like Bonanno said in his piece about insurrectionary anarchism, if you don't know the reason why you get out of bed in the morning to put your 2 feet on the ground, it doesn't actually matter if you're an anarchist or not. Hmm. So I think that where I'd like to kind of start this conversation is, to ask the two of you, what kind of effects do you think, what I call serendipity, but basically circumstance, what kinds of circumstances do you think that can really affect a person trying to come up with a five-year plan as an anarchist? And so, Plast, why don't we start with you?
Effects of serendipity? What do you mean by that? Like snafus you come across along the way?
The different circumstances that you're born into. So, circumstances could be, at least in my opinion, things like the trades that your parents have so they're able to train you, the amount of money that you're born into, the location that you find yourself in, and these kinds of things. So essentially, there are a lot of people who have great imaginations for the kinds of things that it is that they'd like to accomplish. But for someone in the South who, let's say, isn't living in a situation like Los Angeles or New York, in what ways do you think that your circumstances might be different than someone who lives in one of those places?
I think the challenge is going to be a lot greater than someone who lives in like a high population city with a lot of young people. Generally, people in my area are very skeptical of anything that promises anything good. And they generally want the product of the thing, and they don't really want to have to talk to anyone to get it. In some places, you'll find people where they want to make genuine human connection, but they tend to isolate themselves, and that's not really like it's like a closed club, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So I think the main obstacle for me would definitely be trying to generate excitement and energy around things.
And then what about you, Hemlock?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, it's important to like gain support for any project, unless one that, you know, is only being carried out by one person, like a small, you know, affinity group or something like that. But when you mentioned conditions, the first thing that comes to mind for me, I would kind of break it down into like personal, interpersonal, and then material. So like, you know, like personal circumstances being like your mental health or like things you have going on in your life, interpersonal, be like relationships, be they like romantic or friendships or whatever else. And then material being, you know, resources, like capital or specific tools, you know, like do you need a car? Do you need property? Do you need money? Like, you know, those kind of things.
Sure. And, you know, I'm living in a city that has so many universities in it that it's so hard to escape university culture. And I mean, within, I would say probably a 10 block radius, there are probably just as many colleges in that space. Right. So one of the things that I think is fascinating, especially with a growing university population, is universities are constantly teaching high tech, the cutting edge. You know, when you leave college today, you are likely to get a job doing this, and they are likely to be using this software or this technique or this tradition. And I think that leaves people lacking in terms of being able to come up with a long-term plan is, you know, when you come out of college, those things aren't always waiting for you. And so you could find yourself in a situation where those opportunities are not available, and the opportunities that are available are lesser tech than what is being taught in the university, but you have no idea how to work it because it's considered obsolete, even though, in my opinion, its execution is still incredibly valuable. And so that kind of like leads me into, I guess, the next question, which is about appropriate education, which I think is something that universities don't really think about. They think about education in general. And we used to have something called a vocational school where in a classroom setting, people would actually teach you trades. And so you would leave school with appropriate education for a particular trade. But we don't really see that anymore. So Hemlock, what do you think about this idea of appropriate education and like maybe different ways that we might be able to encourage its growth in the anarchist community?
Yeah, I think the problem with education, especially when you look at it from like a mainstream perspective, is that it's usually behind barriers that prohibit access, of having it be something that's like very guarded and need to have a certain degree of like privilege in order to obtain it, or at least the ability to like, you know, seek grants and like give up like a certain amount of time. And I think it's really important to find ways that we can like decentralize education, and that we can free up knowledge and make it more accessible to more folks. And that's everything from like, you know, knowledge in a conventional sense, to like anarchist specific knowledge, to things that are more practical or applicable. You know, like if you want to learn how to like pick locks, like that's good. Like go look it up online and like get some tools and learn how to do it. Like teach your friends, you know?
Yeah. And so what about you, Plast?
I agree with Hemlock on like the barrier of certain things like money to pay for the actual tuition being a large problem. How would you want to organize these things where you teach people how to do certain skills? Because it has to be something where it's like sort of always available. Like if I say I want to learn how to pickle something, I need to be able to find a person to pickle. How would you organize that sort of thing is my question.
I think it's
a great idea. I would just like to see more details fleshed out on it.
You can do it. I mean, I think for a long time we have like in anarchist communities had like a zine culture where we have all kinds of zines, but a lot of them are like basic how to's and we circulate those as paper copies. But now we have, you know, online zines, we have blogs, we have, you know, YouTube channels where people can offer skill shares, but also offering them in like a community setting where you can have classes and make them accessible for free or, you know, very cheap to, for people to come and like learn skills, like in like a person to person or a classroom or like even like an informal setting, you know?
And I would agree with this to an extent. And I think that the zine culture is a really good example. You know, and honestly, if you think about websites, each website is kind of its own zine. So the internet and the sort of online education that you can get just from being on different online websites certainly helps. But You know, there are also certain things where I think that you really require a mentor, you know, like,
yeah.
And Plasta, if I'm reading you correctly, I think that this is probably where you're going. And, you know, two different subjects that I can think about in particular, you know, one is if you're trying to run, let's say, a worker cooperative or a business, because what you're faced with such a situation is a constantly changing combination of challenges that you really can't learn about how to overcome in a classroom setting. You really need a mentor to be there holding your hand. And then another one that has been coming up quite a bit, and you know, my apology to vegans for bringing this one up, but it is still simply a very good example, is hunting. You can look up a lot of information online about how to do this, but without someone who's actually willing to go out there with you and hold your hand while you're doing it, it can be very different to learn like hunting online versus hunting from a mentor.
Mm. Yeah, I would agree. I mean, the internet is touted as like this great resource for learning pretty much anything you want online. But if you've ever tried to learn anything exclusively online that wasn't anything more than like a quick skill or like a how-to, like a very short how-to, it's very difficult because often you do need a person there who's like mastered the skill, who can show you how to get past things that you might get stuck on for months if you're learning it by yourself.
And I think this is one of those things that having a 5-year plan probably really helps with, is because if you have that, then you can begin to recognize the kinds of skills that you can, that you need, that you can get online, or that you might need to get from an actual face-to-face resource. And so, you know, if you're collaborating with others or if you're doing it by yourself, this is one of those things that can encourage you to now in this step, because you can see it coming, you know how long it's going to be before you end up having to actually be with this person 3 months, 6 months out. You can set up an appointment with someone like this to actually start spending that time with them. And again, I think that's one of those things that is sort of the importance of a plan.
Well, yeah, if I can cut in, also the importance of viewing, like gaining the specific like knowledge or skills in the context of like a longer term plan. I mean, I feel like there's a lot of folks out there who have a pretty like strong inclination towards like self-guided learning, but maybe it doesn't always fit into the context of like a greater plan. And I think that the more that we plan for things that are long term, we can get a better inventory of the kind of knowledge that we want to obtain, and we can use it as a framework for how we approach learning.
I think that's definitely true. Like just rapid prototyping, you know, it's challenging to even come up with a 5-year plan if you haven't already been out there experimenting with a whole bunch of shit to find out what you are passionate about and what you're really right. Just not that passionate about. Mm-hmm. And this kind of like, I don't know, this brings up this other concept, which is like, I've had some conversations with some people in my life who say that coming up with a plan that starts with you going solo, as opposed to you collaborating with a group of friends or an affinity group or a collective or what have you, there seem to be two different camps. Like a group of people that say, if you want to get anything done, you have to do it yourself. And then there are a group of people who say that if you want to go far, then you can't go it alone. And so, Plas, what are some of your experiences with this as far as which of these two, going solo or going with others, seems to bear the most fruit?
I don't like that dichotomy at all.
Yeah.
Because I think I usually have to build up steam by myself, and then people usually hop on. Like when I try to create spaces in which I can have conversations with people in regards to politics, a lot of the work is just me doing it by myself. And then people like see, oh, hey, look at this thing. And they trickle in a little bit. And then the more people, it gets more people and so on and so forth. So I like solo projects mostly because like you don't have to argue with anyone about anything. So I think if I had to pick one, I'd prefer solo projects. But if I'm doing group projects, you still have to start it off alone and do a lot of the work by yourself.
That quality seeks quality kind of stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
And then what about you, Hemlock?
I mean, I think it's important to draw a distinction between when we're doing like long-term things versus projects that are very short-term. But I had this discussion with Not Null earlier tonight, actually, where for myself, when I'm looking at long-term plans, I have people in my networks who are working on projects that I'm interested in. And these are people who I enjoy working with and with whom I share like affinity and common goals and values. It's kind of a thing where like, if there's no specific timeline for those projects and then I can like monitor and see results, I can't base my plans around them solely, unless I want to be disappointed. So my response has been to kind of like have an idea of where I want to be in a longer term, make steps to achieve that. And then to also periodically check in with people I know who do have long-term projects and see where they're at until I'm at a point where I can better formulate the specifics and particulars of like a long-term project.
And so like, I guess just kind of a off the wall question here, there's a lot to be said about how actions require a lot of planning and consistency and persistence in order to actually execute them without endangering the plan that we have in mind. And so you're talking about kind of jumping in with a lot of other people's projects. And, you know, I kind of wonder, like, if what we're always doing is looking about how to offer mutual aid to people, in how many situations do you feel like that ends up being a distraction? Like, how many of us are so constantly trying to be helpful that we aren't actually helpful to ourselves and our own plan?
Yeah, and I do see that more like in the short term. Like if you're living in a setting where you have folks around in your networks or in your immediate space who often require a lot of help, that can look in many ways as a distraction. But I see it as like a part of essential practice in a lot of ways. I do think it's important to like set good boundaries and to not overextend oneself and to know the ways you can be helpful in the short term with other people's stuff, and also when you can make sure that you're putting enough time and effort into your projects and like long-term goals.
Sure. And some distractions aren't really ever really discussed is domestic partnerships. You know, just getting lost in a relationship can really take us off the path of what our plan is. And then other sorts of things that are sort of a taboo subject, but in my opinion, maybe even more important to talk about in the anarchist sense, which is substance abuse. You know, with our with our connection to punk rock specifically, we have a lot of alcoholics and we have a lot of people who really favor a lot of disassociatives. So, you know, Plas, what are your thoughts on just being distracted from your plan as you go along?
I absolutely despise escapism, and I think it's one of the reasons why anarchism hasn't taken off at all, because when you have this nice, comfortable, warm spectacle to retreat to whenever you feel the slightest bit uncomfortable or miserable, you don't have a chance to engage with authentic human emotions and have authentic human relations that you'd find in anarchy or anywhere else in real life, like having a real adventure. In regards to drugs, I think generally it's not like a great thing, because a lot of people don't really know how to handle their stuff properly. Some people do. Some people moderate the way they intake that sort of thing. But this idea where it's like, I guess, punk rock to like do drugs and not really get a lot of crap done, I don't really like it. I think it just encourages people being wastemen.
Yeah. And that kind of reminds me of like this dialogue that's going on about the tragedy that happened at the synagogue in Pittsburgh. You know, there was a lot of talk about how it was terrible, and yes, there is an anti-fascist community defense concept that is reactionary to the existence of this kind of a thing. But essentially, you know, one of the things that I wonder is if we have a long-term plan, is there any kind of way that we can actually expect that a five-year plan might be something that could proactively address this kind of a tragedy before it happens, rather than us always being on the reactionary side of this kind of a tragedy? What are your thoughts, Hemlock?
I mean, I think that ties into a lot of like community defense, and it seems like that's usually seen as a reaction, but we need to have an almost like offensive take on it as anarchists. Like a lot of it is in response to when we see violence, like from the far right or from the state, that we want to make these things. But I think it extends beyond that. Like one of the ways that we can succeed like in our insurrection is not just in like subverting power, but also replacing it with things that are organized horizontally and that are accessible. And I think look at Pittsburgh, for example. Like you see all these, you know, Jewish communities that are now like have this very like renewed sense of fear after what happened, and they're now arming themselves. And that's good and that's important, but I think it's the thing that we need to do preemptively, and we need to have these systems like in place. And it's never too late or too early to do that. I think the time is always now. And the more that we can form alternatives to things like, you know, like police or any of these systems that we're trying to escape, the more we can be free of them, but also provide a good example to others to follow suit and establish them like in their own communities.
Well, like an Antifa rifle association, like having classes where you train people how to use guns and defend yourself and things like that.
I mean, that's one example, and those things already exist, but yeah.
And yet this is still reactionary if you think about it. And if you think about the police in terms of having a long-term plan, they have had centuries of planning in order to make the police operate. And yet what mm-hmm. we're talking about doing is really jumping in as citizens at the drop of a hat. And, you know, just to kind of build off of what it is that you're talking about, Hemlock, and then I'm going to hand this off to Plast, is, you know, this concept that we're talking about right now also kind of reminds me of this other thing, which is, you know, you have these actions of opportunity, of convenience mm-hmm. that are constantly happening in city centers. And I feel like people sense that they can signal to the people around them that like this is not acceptable. And so we're going to have an anti-fascist march, or we're going to fight Nazis in the street because they're already here. But essentially, I feel like city protests are designed to return activists back to the status quo after the action is over. Right. What are your thoughts, Plast?
Wait, you mean like it's like a catharsis, and then it's like sort of like the period at the end of the sentence of a tragedy?
Yeah, exactly. It's the punctuation. It's like, in my opinion, if there was some kind of a plan about how it is that we could proactively expect that these kinds of things are going to happen, and that some people might actually be dedicated to creating projects that address the roots that create these kinds of conditions, we might find ourselves in a different situation. And I'm not saying that the reactionary forces are bad, because I think that they're doing great work. I'm simply saying that I wonder if with longer term planning, we might end up with something that looks different that can work in tandem with that. And so, you know, what I'm kind of asking you is, do you think that there is something that exists outside of this paradigm of essentially having protests in the hornet's nest? Like, do you see any kind of effective project that might happen outside of cities with a little bit of planning and a little bit of persistence?
In regards to preventing tragedies like this?
Or just in general, not only distancing ourselves from or preventing tragedies like this, but also other tragedies, like the tragedy of the police coming into contact with communities, or the tragedy of poverty, or the tragedy of the drudgery of work. I just sense that, you know, so much of our concentration is on the city. Do you think that there is anything that can happen outside of this very convenient paradigm with just a little planning?
Honestly, I think that one of the weakest points of anarchy/anarchism is how they try to deal with justice, because it's a very difficult thing to do. Like, if you imagine how like a commune without any state intervention would have to handle like a murder or something like that, I think it'd be an absolute disaster. And I don't think I'm wrong in saying that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very difficult thing to do. I think the only thing you really can do is give the tools people need to defend themselves and spot these things. And that's really all you can do, and leave it up to the discretion of the individual.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have a group of people who are armed and are on the lookout for that sort of thing, that in and of itself prevents most of the crime, in my opinion. Like, I don't, when you have a group of people and they know what they're doing and they're prepared for things, you don't see anyone trying to pull, like, trick anyone or commit any petty crimes within a small group because they know they'd get caught. So I think you could extend that to, like, a group or like a city or a town or whatever. If you have everyone prepared and looking out for these things, then I think that the chances of something like this happening would go down drastically. I doubt that that man would have the, I don't want to say courage, like this is a good thing. I doubt he would have the courage to do any of that if he knew that that community was armed and ready for that.
Mm.
And I mean, trying to engineer a culture that prevents this, I think is very, very difficult and it gets into very messy things.
And one of the challenges for this, and then I'll ask Hemlock the same question, is simply that neighborhoods aren't what they used to be. You know, people are constantly moving. Jobs aren't what they used to be. People are constantly moving. And so being able to have that kind of a core isn't what it used to be, because it is a new stranger every couple of months to a year. And so being able to build that hive is very challenging. What are your thoughts, Hemlock?
I feel like we need to do a better job as anarchists of channeling our outrage into projects that yield tangible results. I think that, you know, public outrage and symbolic actions have value to an extent, but people tend to stop there. And I think it's only when you are able to build like a insurrectionary infrastructure that you can start to solve problems instead of just being mad about them.
And so this brings me up to my last question. And this one was given to me by a friend who was basically asking, where does our understanding of executing these plans, like where does our understanding of DIY or do it yourself begin and end? Because it so far seems like the anarchist imagination only extends as far as food production. So what are your thoughts on that, Hemlock?
I mean, could you rephrase the question?
Yeah. So basically what we're talking about here is, you know, we find ourselves in a situation where we are reacting to community violence. Mm-hmm. And so what we were talking about doing is coming up with more robust projects that can be more proactive than reactive.
Right.
And producing things that actually have tangible value outside of pure theory. And so what I'm asking...
Stop. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you go ahead.
So what I'm saying is basically that the imagination of the anarchist so far when this conversation happens seems to be about land projects and farming, even though so few anarchists are actually educated farmers.
Right. I think the biggest thing is we need to stop looking at our actions as incidental, and we need to focus on things that are permanent and lasting. Even if we're just creating models, instead of things that are going to, you know, price they're going to last for like, you know, 10 or more years. I think it's looking in that way. And I think a good example is if you look at like, if you were to compare like, you know, Occupy ICE or action camps for Occupy Wall Street and compare them to like Lazada in France, you know, like Lazada is a permanent occupation. And yeah, it has a lot of flaws like at this point in its lifespan and a lot of like internal like infighting things that happen. But they've made, I think, a larger impact in one place because they have that like longevity and because they haven't abandoned it. And I think it's really important to look at things in that way. And we need to have projects that are visible, viable, and necessary, and to not abandon them when they become difficult.
Hell yeah. And so, Plas, we've got about 5 minutes left. And same question, you know, and just to build off of this word visible, you know, besides the visibility of land projects and farms, what kinds of things do you think exist that we can be doing for ourselves right now?
Recruiting people who have a certain role first. Like, that is to say, like, don't find more anarchists, find engineers, find masons, find farmers and make them anarchists. I think it's vitally important we get people who actually have experience in these areas, because while it is nice to try to become a jack of all trades, let's be honest, I'd rather have an actual farmer help me out with the farming project than someone who read a gardening book one time.
Sure enough. And, you know, this is, of course, not a simple subject. It is complicated. You know, that's one of those things kind of about coming up with a long-term plan, is trying to take something very complicated and break it down into smaller bite-sized parts. I don't imagine anyone in the anarchist news comments are going to be sharing what their five-year plans are, because I don't think that they think that far out ahead. But in any event, I hope that perhaps a couple of us might share what we have in mind. So I'd like to thank the two of you for joining us.
No problem.
And I look forward to next week.
This podcast is the effort of many people. This week, the podcast was sound edited by Lynn O'Mabel. What's New was written by Jackie and read by Chisel and Dim. The editorial was written by Chisel. We thank Aragorn and Friend for their help with the topic of the week. Contact us at podcast@anarchistnews.org. To learn more, anarchist and anti-political books, pamphlets, and other material are available at littleblackcart.com. And for news by and or by anarchists and up-to-the-minute commentary, go to anarchistnews.org.